From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. CDC Director Rochelle Walensky is urging parents to get their adolescent children vaccinated against COVID-19. The FDA granted emergency authorization for the Pfizer-BioNTech shot yesterday in kids between the ages of 12 and 15. Here's Walensky at a Senate hearing earlier today.
I am encouraging all parents to get their children vaccinated. Some parents won't want to be first, but I'm also encouraging children to ask for the vaccine. I have a 16-year-old myself, and I can tell you he wanted to get the vaccine. He wants his life back. These kids want to go back to school. They want to go back to the things they love.
Joining us now is Dr. Peter Hotez. He's a pediatrician and dean at Baylor's National School of Tropical Medicine in Houston. Dr. Hotez, welcome back.
Oh, thanks for having me.
And getting kids between 12 and 15 vaccinated, what does it mean for the fight against this pandemic?
Well, it's important. Well, first of all, it's important because with this B.1.1.7 variant, we are seeing a lot of young adults and adolescents going into hospitals and getting very sick and also long-haul COVID. So I think protecting that population is important. Also, if we can have all of the adolescents vaccinated, think of what that's going to mean for middle schools and high schools. You'll have the kids vaccinated, the teachers, the staff, the bus drivers. That's going to make for a very safe school year. And even though the little kids won't be vaccinated by then, all of that will help to reduce transmission, because if we can reach 70-75% of the entire U.S. population vaccinated, then we'll see a big slowdown in transmission. So it really does help the country as well.
The first question that many parents will have is whether this shot is safe for their children, and you would say what to them?
Yeah, well, the FDA has got a great track record of only releasing vaccines that are safe. They have really done extraordinary work to put in all of the checks and balances needed to ensure that safety and to monitor the vaccines even if they're released through pharmacovigilance. The data looks really good in adolescents, both for efficacy, as was mentioned in the testimony. There were 2,400 kids in that study. 1,200 got the vaccine, 1,200 placebo, 18 cases in the placebo, none in the vaccinated group. So technically, that's 100%. It probably won't hold up that well, you know, as you expand the population. But it's really good, very high levels of virus neutralizing antibody. And the safety performance looks about the same in adolescents as it does in adults.
President Biden said that 20,000 pharmacies are ready to give vaccine to kids in that age group. He also said the government is going to ship doses directly to pediatricians. What do you think the best way is to get those shots into kids' arms? Is it different from the way we've gotten adults vaccinated?
Yeah, no, it varies. I mean, some parents know. I mean, take, for instance, the HPV vaccine for cervical cancer and other cancers. That's given to also young adolescents. Some parents want to have those shots given by the pediatrician. Totally understandable. And the pediatrician can provide a lot of information to parents. But the pharmacists are now really getting well educated about these particular mRNA vaccines. And some parents may want to opt for the convenience of the pharmacy. So I think that's a good plan. The more accessible we can make it, the better.
Well, look, doctor, many adults still aren't getting the shot, even though we know it's safe. And parents who've gotten vaccinated themselves may still not feel comfortable giving a dose to their children. So do you think that hesitancy will be an even bigger issue for kids in this age group than it has been for adults?
Yeah, and it may actually exacerbate the current geographic disparity we have in vaccinating the U.S. population. If, you know, you look at the list of states in terms of how they're doing in terms of vaccinating, the best states overwhelmingly are the New England states, New York, California, New Jersey, New Mexico, basically all blue or bluish states. They're reaching really high levels, over 60% single dose, 45% two doses. So we're getting to numbers that look like what Israel finally did when they lowered transmission. But then you go to the states in the South, like Georgia, Tennessee, Louisiana, Mississippi, or Idaho and Wyoming in the mountain areas. They're almost half that level, around half that level. So that's only going to get exacerbated, I think, when it comes to their kids as well. So we've got this terrible blue state, red state divide.
You know, even my 12-year-old daughter, when hearing this news this morning, said there was no way she was going to get a shot, even though the adults in our home have all been vaccinated. Just briefly, we have 30 seconds here. Do you
what
see
was
a point
reason?
Where these – well, because her kid, her friends at school – didn't do it, or their families weren't doing it, and so that was her reason. She didn't want to do it with peer pressure, essentially. So interesting questions to be asked here. You know, parents are going to have to decide and how to navigate issues like that. Dr. Peter Hotez, we're going to move on here, but thank you so much for your time. Dean of Baylor's National School of Tropical Medicine in Houston, thank you so much.
Many thanks.
Liz Cheney may be ousted as GOP conference chair as soon as tomorrow. Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy says House Republicans will vote on removing the Wyoming representative over her opposition to former President Donald Trump. Representative Cheney also criticized Trump's role in the January 6th insurrection at the Capitol and voted to impeach the president for his role in the attack. Here's a question now. Have we been here before? Let's get some historical perspective on this from Julian Zelizer. He's the professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. And Julian, has a one-term president like Trump ever held such sway over his party after losing an election?
Well, usually the sway is negative. So you have presidents like Herbert Hoover or Jimmy Carter who become models for a lot of the party about what not to do. And so the kind of hold in a positive direction that President Trump seems to have is pretty unusual. Grover Cleveland, of course, is the only other president who won the non-consecutive terms.
Is this push to get Cheney out as GOP conference chair designed to help Republicans regain control of the House next year? Are Republicans who want to push Cheney aside thinking we need to appeal to the millions of people who voted for Trump in the short term?
Absolutely. I think Republicans are feeling very good about the midterms. The majorities for the Democrats are pretty narrow in both the House and Senate. And I think if Republicans hold the line and they energize the Trump voter, they believe that that could possibly give them control of Congress again, which would be a check to President Biden and a step forward possibly to a victory in 2024. So I think that's exactly the logic.
You know, I asked the question, have we been here before? Are there other moments when the major political parties had divisions like what we're seeing today?
Oh, for sure. I mean, between the early 1900s and the 1980s, Democrats were a deeply divided party between Southern Democrats, who were very conservative on issues like race and unions, and Northerners like Hubert Humphrey of Minnesota, who were at the forefront of the civil rights movement. And being a party leader during that entire period meant holding these two factions together.
You know, looking back, though, is there evidence that parties sometimes can misread the mood of the country or misread their own supporters?
For sure. In 1964, Republicans nominate Senator Barry Goldwater as their presidential candidate, a right-wing Republican. And some delegates thought the conservative wave was here. But they were wrong. And because of that, Lyndon Johnson wins re-election by a landslide. Liberal Democrats gain huge majorities in Congress, and the Great Society begins.
You know, we know that voters turn to other parties when they're not happy with the two major parties. But we've heard from a lot of our listeners over the last year to 2 years who say, as a nation, we focus too much on a two-party system. What do you think the future holds for other parties beyond the Republicans and Democrats?
I think at the local level, there's been some room for third parties to do well. We've seen that with Social Democrats, for example. But in general, the two political parties are very strong. They have a lot of organizational resources in terms of money and Washington-based interest groups. And at the electoral level, there's not a lot of voters who are departing. So even someone like Liz Cheney, who remains a conservative Republican, is an outlier. And I don't think the two parties are going to go away anytime soon, despite this kind of frustration.
Right. As you say, she's a conservative Republican. What does this fight over Cheney's future tell us about really the future of the Republican Party?
It means the party of Trump and the GOP are one in the same. And there is no room for any kind of defection. And anyone who challenges who the head of the party is right now is going to suffer this kind of purge. And I think the Cheney story makes this very clear.
What will you be looking for and listening for tomorrow during this expected vote to remove Liz Cheney as GOP conference chair?
Well, the obvious thing to look for, is there anyone who stands with her? Are there any Republicans who make some sort of forceful statement that the party can have room for people who don't believe that Donald Trump is the future of the party? Or is there just silence and we don't hear anything? And I think, again, that will be indicative of how much of an outlier she is at this point.
Julian Zelizer is professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. As always, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
The results of China's once-a-decade census are in, and they show that the population grew by just under 5.4%. It's the smallest percentage jump in the last four decades. In this story that first aired on Morning Edition, NPR's Emily Feng tells us why it matters.
For weeks leading up to today's much-delayed announcement, there was widespread speculation the total population might drop for the first time in about 60 years. The Financial Times put out a report in April claiming just that, prompting China's Statistics Bureau to issue a curt statement saying China's population had risen and it would release the data later. So today, there was a lot of anticipation about this normally routine survey. Here's Ning Zizhe, who leads China's Statistics Bureau. He says the total population of mainland China is 1.41 billion people, only 72 million more than the decade before. That's the slowest growth since China implemented its one-child policy, restrictions now repealed, that limited every family to having just one child starting in the late 1970s. The one-child policy is now the two-child policy, as in most families can have up to two children, but few families are. That's because childcare costs are rising, and changing social mores are lowering early marriage rates, boosting divorce, and pushing back when people want children. Fewer people, especially of working age, is a problem for economic growth. China's 60 and above population was the fastest growing demographic group in the last decade. Here's Ning again. The level of aging within our societies continues to deepen, Ning says, which means China continues to face the pressure of having to maintain population sustainability. And more aging means less money going into the state pension to support more elderly people and fewer workers to power China's labor-dependent economy. Emily Fang, NPR News, Yan'an, China.
When somebody dies unexpectedly or under suspicious circumstances, coroners often help determine what caused their death. But unlike medical examiners, coroners are not typically required to have medical degrees. That's been a cause for criticism for many doctors and public health experts for years. And now some say it's complicating efforts to respond to the coronavirus pandemic as well. Kate Wong is senior editor at Scientific American, and she joins us now to talk about this. Hi, Kate.
Thanks so much for having me. It's great to be here.
You recently wrote an editorial headlined, "Those who investigate premature deaths should have medical training." We'll link people to it at hereandnow.org. Can you give us a sense of what standards exist for coroners in the U.S. and how widespread the use of coroners is versus certified physicians?
Sure. There's no federal oversight of death investigation in the U.S. So instead, states decide whether they use medical examiners or coroners. And in most states, they have coroners in at least some counties. So the counties actually within a state can differ in the systems that they use. And sometimes the coroners work together with medical examiners. But in some situations, even when they are working together, the coroner still can be the one who has the final say on what goes on the death certificate.
You point out in your article that a recent investigation by the news service Stat found tens of thousands of deaths from COVID are going unreported, and that counties that use elected coroners actually had higher rates of uncounted COVID deaths than counties that use appointed medical examiners. Can you talk about the impacts of this on public health?
Sure. Yeah. The current coronavirus pandemic is a really good and frightening example of the consequences for public health. You know, the virus responsible for COVID is a leading cause of pneumonia. So when someone dies without having had a COVID test, a coroner can attribute the death to a direct cause, such as pneumonia, without ever mentioning COVID as the underlying cause on the death certificate. And so the study that you mentioned from STAT found that counties that use elected coroners had higher rates of uncounted COVID deaths than counties that use appointed medical examiners.
This is not a new problem. However, NPR was actually part of a year-long investigation on this issue back in 2011 that found a dysfunctional system short on qualified people, squeezed for resources and lacking in oversight. Has the problem gotten any better in recent years, based on your reporting? Are states changing their standards anywhere?
Yeah, I mean, you know, leading medical and scientific organizations have been criticizing the use of elected coroners since the 1800s, arguing that we should replace them with appointed medical examiners. But just 16 states and Washington, D.C. have centralized medical examiner systems. So we have a long way to go. States need to abolish the coroner system and replace it with a centralized system of using medical examiners who are appointed to those roles rather than elected to carry out investigations into premature deaths.
That's Kate Wong, senior editor at Scientific American. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Tanya.
Well, let's get another perspective. John Feudenberg is executive director of the International Association of Coroners and Medical Examiners. Last year, he retired as the coroner for Clark County, Nevada, which is home to Las Vegas. And John, you disagree that there should be a federal standard on medical certifications for coroners. Why?
The big issue is that this debate on whether a system should be a medical examiner system or a coroner system is nearly a century old, and a system should really have three components to operate appropriately, and that is an administrator to manage the resources and a forensic pathologist who determines the cause of death and practices medicine within the office. And then the third part that's often not mentioned is the importance of a medical legal investigator. We should, as coroner and medical examiner's office, be independent from law enforcement when possible. And whether the system is called a medical examiner system or a coroner system, to us is irrelevant. It's really whether or not they're using certified staff and whether or not their offices are accredited. Those are the important things that we're trying to promote.
Well, John, what about, though, in small rural coroner's offices that perhaps don't have the same resources? Would you agree that it can be an issue there?
It certainly can be an issue there. And most of America is rural, right? And oftentimes they don't have access to a forensic pathologist. But I don't believe that in the homicides, the suicides, the motor vehicle accidents, those types of sudden unexplained death, those are generally referred to a forensic pathologist. Even in rural America, the coroner will send the decedent to a forensic pathologist for the medical determination of death.
John, what about this investigation, though, by the News Service STAT that associated the prevalence of elected coroners with uncounted COVID deaths? What's your response to that?
First of all, most elected coroners reside in rural areas. I don't buy into the fact that elected coroners are under-reporting COVID deaths for political purposes. I certainly wouldn't deny that happens in certain parts of rural America. But as a whole, I don't buy into that theory. I don't believe it.
It's more than just political, though. I mean, does this concern you that during a pandemic, we may not know the full scope and count of those who have died of COVID? And so in a way, this is a public health issue.
Well, it's absolutely concerning, but I don't think that's the reason we're going to have inaccurate numbers is because coroners aren't medically trained. I'll give you a good example, and that is that if, you know, during the first 6 months, testing was very difficult to obtain. So if we had a decedent come through our office or if they had a decedent die in a hospital and they couldn't get a COVID test, even if they exhibited the symptoms, the physician or the coroner or the medical examiner is generally not going to attribute that death to COVID-19, even though logically it was contributed to COVID, but it's not how we practice in the medical legal world.
What about this system of electing coroners who can be lay people versus requiring medical examiners to be appointed? Do you think the profession and the public would be better off if all coroners were appointed instead of elected?
Well, I do. I think that they would be better off, but not necessarily for the same purpose other people believe that. I think they're better off for the simple fact that you can generally appoint somebody that has the experience and the education versus getting somebody that's elected that may not have the experience or education. In addition to that, 4 years is not a long time to learn a system. The coroner medical examiner offices are very complex operations. And to think that you're going to have a new coroner every 4 years in accordance with an election cycle, it's not a great idea because it takes a long time to learn exactly what's happening. So, however, when you have 27 to 2,900 elected coroners in the country, most of which are constitutional officers in their jurisdiction, you're not going to abolish those systems. So this century-long debate about abolishing coroners' offices is frankly a ridiculous concept. What we're trying to promote is that these coroners should be educated, that they should have training, that they should be certified, and they should consider themselves a medical legal investigator and be certified as such, and depend on the forensic pathologist to determine the cause of death, which our stance is that that's the practice of medicine.
That's John Feudenberg, Executive Director of the International Association of Coroners and Medical Examiners. John, thank you very much.
Thank you, Tanya.
Today, it seems like everybody's got a bone to pick with the news. So it happens when somebody stops talking smack and just decides to wage all-out war.
First thing you do in an invasion, you eliminate the communications of the enemy.
And what happens if they win? Visit Stockton, California, for a story about a revolt against the mainstream media that's shaken up a city. From NPR's Invisibilia.
We're going to go to the escalating violence in the Middle East now. Israel has launched a series of new airstrikes on Gaza today as Hamas and other groups bombarded southern Israel with rockets. NPR's Daniel Estrin joins us now from Jerusalem. And Daniel, tell us more about what's happening there right now. Is the situation deteriorating today?
It is. Violence is escalating. Militants in Gaza have fired a few hundred rockets at Israel. Many were intercepted by Israel's anti-missile battery, but not all of them. Two civilians were killed in rocket attacks in a southern Israeli city. In one home, a rocket apparently killed, according to media reports, a woman from India working as a caregiver for an elderly Israeli woman. And then in another building, a tall residential building, a rocket hit an upper floor apartment. And then, meanwhile, and in that building, one woman also dead. Israel carried out strikes in Gaza targeting militants. Israel also targeted homes where Israel said militants were based. But civilians were also reportedly killed, according to officials there. At least 28 Palestinians killed, including children and a woman. And my colleagues in Gaza say it's just the sound of bombing and rocket firing. You can hear it everywhere there.
Huh. Well, if we back up a day or so, the violence, this latest round of it, is flaring because of tensions and clashes where you are in Jerusalem near the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. It's a contested ground. Just remind us why, what's happening.
Well, the Al-Aqsa Mosque is the central holy site in Jerusalem for Muslims. It's also revered by Jews as the site of the ancient temple. And there have been a whole slew of events that have taken place in Jerusalem over Ramadan, this holy month for Muslims, centering around that site. First of all, as Palestinians pray there and they gather every Ramadan night, police have attempted crowd control. And Palestinians just see it as a message of, you are not wanted here in this city. And so almost nightly, we've seen confrontations in Jerusalem. Jerusalem between police and Palestinians. Then there have been pending evictions of Palestinian families in a Jerusalem neighborhood where Jewish settler groups are working the courts to try to claim properties there. That is on hold for the moment. But meanwhile, police and Palestinians have confronted each other on the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex. Officers pelted with stones. Then we've seen officers charge into the mosque buildings, and hundreds of Palestinians every day have been wounded.
And I know you've been visiting some of those civilians that have been wounded. What are you seeing? What are you hearing?
I visited a hospital today to get a sense of some of these wounds. None were lethal, but doctors said that the kind of wounds we saw indicate that police were firing from a close distance, what they say. Most wounds to the face and chest, Palestinian men, 8 of them, blinded. And I met some of them in their hospital beds. I met a mother who just looked shell-shocked, wondering how her teenage son would go through life without his eye. Most of these injuries caused by rubber-tipped bullets fired by police, these small canisters with a rounded kind of a rubber tip. And Israel says this response is justified. It says masses were chanting pro-Hamas slogans, the Islamist group, confronting police with rocks. And this is part of the tensions that have just been building for days and days now.
And I have just about 30 seconds here, Daniel, but are we headed towards a longer, more drawn-out conflict, do you think?
We are. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says Israel will be expanding its offensive on Gaza. And we are seeing protests in the West Bank and also in cities inside Israel between Jews and Arabs. Really very personal street fights. It's very worrisome.
All right. Well, we're going to keep an eye on it. Thank you for your reporting. NPR's Daniel Estrin in Jerusalem. Here's something you may not know. Whales have culture. They may not gather around a dinner table every Thanksgiving, but they do have distinctive lifestyles that they've adopted to survive. And that culture is revealed in a new documentary series by National Geographic called Secrets of the Whales. Filmmaker and underwater explorer James Cameron is executive producer.
These sperm whales can emit 230 decibel sound pulse. I mean, that would blow our eardrums in if we were adjacent to them when they fire that thing off.
The documentary explores the complex ways that 5 different types of whales communicate and socialize. World-renowned underwater photographer Brian Scarry spent 3 years diving in oceans around the world capturing these majestic creatures for the film. I last spoke to him 4 years ago about his book of shark photography, and he joins me now again. Brian Scarry, welcome back.
Thanks, Peter. Great to be back.
So this theme, this idea that whales have culture, what does that mean to you exactly? What did you learn about that in doing this?
Right. Well, the notion of culture, I think, is something new in terms of looking at the animal kingdom. And there was one scientist who's become a good friend. His name is Dr. Shane Garrow. And Shane describes the difference between behavior and culture like this. He says, behavior is what we do. Culture is how we do it. So he says, for example, most humans eat food with utensils. That is behavior. But whether you use chopsticks or knives and forks, that is your culture. So within a genetically identical species, let's say orca, they are doing things vastly different in different parts of the world. So they have a preference for international cuisine, their ethnic foods. The orca that live in New Zealand like to eat stingrays, and they have mastered a technique for swimming into very shallow water in mangroves and harbors and grabbing a stingray, turning it upside down, sort of immobilizing it with tonic immobility, putting it to sleep, and then predating on it. And they are the only orca in the world that do that technique. The orca that live in Patagonia, they have a taste for sea lion pups, and they have figured out how to master a technique. The sperm whales that Shane is studying in the Caribbean, he's identified over 24 families that all speak the same dialect or the same language, for lack of a better word, and they don't intermingle with other sperm whales that might move into those waters. So when a sperm whale meets another sperm whale out in those Caribbean waters, the first thing they say is, I am from Dominica. And if the other whale says, I am from Haiti or someplace, they just kind of go their own way. So when I first heard that, I imagined the neighborhoods of New York at the turn of the last century, where you had the Irish and the Italians and all these neighborhoods based on language. So
do you think it is a language? I mean, can we call it that?
Well, I think researchers tend to refrain from using the word language only because I think there's an association with human, but they do use the word dialect. But from my very layman's perspective, yeah, I think they are speaking a language. And this may be a little bit more defined, but there may be some overlap. And, you know, for us, I think the word language works.
Well, this is radio, so let's listen to some of that language that we're talking about here. These are orcas in a recording we got from Disney Nature Soundscapes. We don't know exactly what those whales were saying to each other, but in some ways I think you already have communicated with animals like these, because there was that scene in the episode about orcas hunting those stingrays that you mentioned. Right before this animal was going to swallow it down, here you come, it sees you, and does something amazing. It offers you the stingray, or at least it appears to. Tell me about that experience.
Well, that was extraordinary. As you described, here comes this adult female with a stingray hanging out of her mouth. So my mind is exploding. I can't believe I'm seeing this. And I'm thinking, don't mess it up, you know, get the shot. And then as she approached, she drops it. I swim down, I kneel next to it, and the whale is gone. And I'm thinking, ah, I missed it. Sure enough, she swims behind me, comes around to the left side of my vision, and then the ray is between us on the ocean floor. And the whale is looking at me, looking at the ray, looking at me, looking at the ray, as if to say, are you going to eat that? And when I don't, she very gently bends over, picks it up, and turns, and then another orca comes in, a member of her family, and they begin to food share. I remember talking with James Cameron about this after, who was the executive producer, and he said, well, you know, Brian, a lot of cultures, of course, share food. That's an offering. So I felt guilty after that I didn't eat the ray.
I remember asking you a few years ago what it was like to swim so close to sharks in the ocean, right? I mean, you were getting close up to some of the most ferocious sharks in the sea. You're taking it to a new level with the whales, and you just proved that with the story about the orca, I think. How did the experiences compare?
Boy, that's a great question. It's hard to pick a favorite, but you reach a rarefied plane when you're in the presence of these highly cognitive, sentient animals like whales. They are operating at a very different level. It is like being in the presence of an alien intelligence that, you know, is a little bit different than other animals. Sharks are fish, and not to say that they don't have great personalities and charm as well, but I think it's different with these big-brained, air-breathing mammals that are similar to us in a lot of ways. And they could easily, you know, with a flick of their tail, swim away. But when they do let you in and you get those special moments, it transcends any other experience for me in the ocean.
Did you fear them?
I didn't fear them, no. I think my sort of MO when I'm in the presence of whales is to be very vigilant. But that being said, they tend to be extremely aware. They will often purposely lift a pectoral if they're swimming past me, or move a tail so that they don't bump me. I've never felt danger in any way like that.
Well, the series does touch on the threat of ocean pollution and how dangerous it is for animals. There were moments when you or members of the team would intervene. I want to play this clip. It's when your friend and researcher Shane Garrow cuts debris from an entangled sea turtle before releasing it back into the water.
Okay. That's the third one that I've cut out.
Yep.
And if you're saying you've seen the same, I mean, we spend a lot of time on the water, but that's way too many.
One of the divers actually does the same at one point for an orca, a killer whale. I just wonder how you think, you know, how dangerous that experience was for you and for your team to intervene, especially with the whales, and how you made the decision to do it.
Every one of those situations has to be evaluated, you know, independently.
at least with the sea turtles. These are animals that are, you know, out there in the open ocean. They're completely entangled in plastic or plastic fishing nets. We saw one in Sri Lanka that was towing a laundry basket. We saw a lot of that. So you can't help but want to intervene. That being said, you know, I've been in situations in my life where I've seen animals caught in fishermen's nets, and I don't intervene. I don't want to impact somebody's livelihood unless I'm working with them and they give me the okay to do that, and I've done that as well. With the orca, I wasn't there on that particular day, but I know the cameramen quite well, of course, and I think they made the right call. This was a vertical line with a buoy at the top, and it had one wrap around the male orca's pectoral fin. So the cameraman made the decision to just cut that one line. It wasn't going to impact the fisherman's livelihood. He wasn't going to lose his traps or anything. It was the right thing to do, in my opinion. Again, everyone has to be evaluated independently.
We report so often, we hear so much about the debris and the plastic in the ocean. You are on the water so often, and you see it firsthand. How would you describe how bad the problem is?
Well, it's very bad. You know, I started diving in Massachusetts in 1977, and I don't remember almost ever seeing plastic back in the day. But these days, almost every dive that I make, I see plastic and trash and debris. It's an anomaly if I don't see it. And, you know, it's a huge problem. That stuff just doesn't go away. And it not only entangles so many animals, but it destroys habitats. And the plastic problem is a huge one that I think is solvable, but it's one of many.
National Geographic photographer Brian Scarry, the latest project is Secrets of the Whales. You can stream it now on Disney Plus, and we'll also have photos of some of those whales at hereandnow.org. Brian, always a pleasure. So interesting. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Peter.
If you're on Instagram, you may remember a prompt when you first signed up, reminding you that the app is for people 13 and over. Well, the reality is there are a lot of kids who bypass that warning, and it's actually against the law for them to be there. Well, now Facebook, which owns Instagram, recently announced it's starting a new app for those 13 and under, much like its Messenger for Kids app. And some experts say it is not a solution, but another bad idea that could harm kids' mental health and compromise their safety. More than 40 attorneys general have already asked Facebook to abandon its plans. And joining us now to talk more about this is Josh Golan, executive director of the Campaign for Commercial Free Childhood. Josh, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Yes. So you signed a letter along with several other advocacy groups saying this new app would put children at greater risk. What are your concerns?
Well, the biggest concern is that younger children are not ready to have social media accounts. There are tremendous pressures on sites like Instagram to upload pictures. That leads young people to constantly check their devices to see who has commented on their picture. And we don't want kids doing that. We want kids just to be kids without this thinking that people are out there to judge them and that they should be presenting themselves in a way to receive likes.
What you're talking about is a well-established problem that research has found is actually an issue for kids using social media. But my question to you is that genie already out of the bottle? What you're talking about is kind of a world as if children weren't already on social media. The reality is that kids are already on Instagram and TikTok. What do you say to this argument that Instagram youth, as Facebook is calling it, is a safer version of that for young people?
Well, Instagram has an enormous problem where millions of children are lying their way onto the platform. So it's supposed to be for the age 13 and up, but millions of kids have lied their way onto the platform. That is a problem that Instagram should deal with by using their technical capabilities to identify those children and closing their accounts. I find it so disingenuous that Facebook pretends that the most, you know, one of the most powerful companies in the world could launch a new product aimed at young children and act like that's only going to appeal to people who are only on social media. Economics 101 tells you that this is going to drive a whole drove of new children who wouldn't have accounts otherwise onto social media. Facebook should not be allowed to use the fact that it has failed to protect 10 and 11 and 12-year-olds and blatantly violated the Children's Online Privacy and Protection Act. They should not be allowed to use that as a market opportunity to go after 5 and 6-year-olds.
I want to go back to something you said about this 1998 law called the Children's Online Privacy and Protection Act. You referenced that, and essentially what that is a law that says kids under 13 can't be on these platforms like Instagram. And your argument is that Instagram has failed to really adhere to that law. This is what they're doing as a solution to that. But that greater problem there has still not been fixed.
Yeah, absolutely. So the law says that if you are going to collect personal information from a child under the age of 13, you need to get parental consent before you do that. And Instagram doesn't do that. So all of the under 13s who are on that site in their terms of service, say they're for 13 and up, aren't supposed to be there. Instagram has done very little to remove those accounts. One of the things that's important to understand is even if you lie about your age, you are giving off all sorts of signals about who you are by the photos that you post, by what you're writing in your post. Instagram, through its machine learning, is analyzing every single one of those pictures and posts. So the question that we have always had for companies like Instagram is why don't they use those tools to identify the under 13 users and kick them off the platform to close those accounts? Facebook has not done the work because it's not in their interest. They make money off of those kids.
What would make a good app for kids in your mind? Is there a such thing?
When you are talking about 6, 7, and 8-year-olds, I don't think that social media is appropriate. One of the things that we do on social media, which makes it so powerful, and one of the reasons why as adults we're also addicted to it, is that we quantify everything. We quantify popularity. So I can look at you and immediately tell how many friends you have. If I post a picture of myself, I immediately get rated on how I look. That's not appropriate for younger children. We don't need younger children to have another reason to be online. We don't need children to think that the only way that they can communicate with their peers is through a commercial platform. Coming out of this pandemic, what we need more than anything is opportunities for children to interact face-to-face. Let's let them play with friends in the real world before we place this enormous pressure on them to market themselves, to present themselves to their friends through filters and photo editing. I mean, it's just insane that anybody would think that that's appropriate for a 7 or 8-year-old.
That's Josh Golan, Executive Director of the Campaign for a Commercial-Free Childhood. Josh, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.